You're listening to The Osiris Mounir Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey, my kindreds, yes, that is my piece of art behind me, in case anyone is asking. I did that. I did that all by myself. So anyway, hey, what's happening, my kindreds, my peeps out there, everyone out there in the world? Lots going on. We're in voting season. So I think Proposition 50 passed. Some people were in that. Some people weren't. I don't know. I don't follow politics except enough to just stay abreast of what's going on because I am a citizen of this country. But I don't get into some whole thing. It's too many other things going on that need my attention. So before we start, let's say a shout out to our sponsor, Kevin Pike with Coldwell Banker, Senior Real Estate and Probate Specialist, 818-571-1508. He is absolutely adorable, will do anything and everything to get you to meet your goal about either buying, selling, leasing, whatever you want to do. And he specializes with seniors because seniors often are taken advantage of. So don't forget that. Again, Kevin Pike, Coldwell Banker, 818-571-1508. Now to our show. So let's talk about our shout outs today. I got a shout out to Marie and Thomas. Marie and her partner, they run, not Thomas, but her partner who runs Chachi's in San Pedro. It's a sandwich shop. It's beautiful. I saw photos of it. So if you guys go to chachis.com, C-H-A-C-H-I-S, I believe, also on IG, Chachi's sandwich shop, hot stuff. They got some really good food, and she promised me a sandwich, so, you know. But I have heard of them before and had never met anyone that worked there, so shout out to Marie and her partner at Chachi's. Shout out to my girl who does a lot to help me look presentable every week. On my show, she will get me things, buy me things. If she sees something that would look hot on me, she will say, sis, I'm getting this for you. Gabrielle Graff Palmer, her company is called Bright Light Events. So she does a lot. Her hands are full, but Gabrielle Graff Palmer is the person that's responsible for me looking adorbs to you guys every week. We lost D'Angelo, Diane Keaton. I think somebody else died, passed over or crossed over. I like to say that they dropped their skin and they're on the other side. They made it through this stuff. And we also had Dia de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead, celebrated by the Hispanic Comunidad. So celebración to all of those out there that celebrated those things. Now for our guest today. I have this beautiful woman that I've known for a long time, and we have been business more, but now that I am maturing myself and peering into the eyes of others who have gone on before me, who have laid some groundwork for me to take up an arm and for me to be able to get up and talk to you every day, my guest is a former trade show producer. And trade shows our different side of the industry. I'm going to let her just give a little bit about that only because it is a part of entertainment, but something that people don't talk about much. She's also the founder and producer of MMLA, Making Music LA. I think it's called Fête de la Musique in French. If you like French, Dorsey Dujon is our guest, and we're going to bring her on right now and talk to her about some stuff. Hey, Dorsey!
Hey, Osiris. Thank you so much for inviting me to be here today. This is indeed a treat. This is a real treat.
This is fun for me because I don't get to speak to many people of color, also people that are women who have had the kind of experiences that you've had, and still around to tell the story, still in sound mind, you know, still really out here making waves and passing the torches, holding a torch and keeping a torch in one hand to pass it on whenever we get to that point that it needs to be passed. So I want to start off by welcoming you to our show, The Osiris Mounir Show. I want to talk to you. When I first met you many, many years ago, you were talking about your teens, and I think I remember you talking about how your grandmother or mother would dress and they'd have the gloves on and the whole outfit to go to the theater and, you know, take you to these, all these things that most Black kids weren't aware of and weren't privy to. And I want you to talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think my, I come from immigrant parents and I'm
immigrant. Where, from where?
Jamaica.
Jamaica.
Jamaica. So Jamaica's hurting right now. So it needs a lot of love. So folks, if you can dig deep, please send some help towards Jamaica. But my mother and father were both much older when I was born. My mom was 43. And in those days, that was old to be giving birth. And so with her being born in the Victorian era, she was born in 1901. And came to this country at the age of 19. Her way of being and her way of living was what we would call really old-fashioned. And I think that those old-fashioned values, and they happened to really come from English, because Jamaica at that time was a British, it was part of the British West Indies. So both parents had a more of a Victorian thought process. But my mom loved music. She loved the theater. And so, and dance. And they took me places. And at the same time, the West Indian community was very well knit. They had their own, you know, loaning companies, and they took care of each other. When someone came off a boat to the United States, there was someone to greet them and someone to help them get into a place, get a job. It was a very interesting time for them. And in terms of being immigrants, they helped one another a great deal. So given this kind of mentality, it trickled down to me. And they both had been married before and had families, but I was the only one from this particular marriage. And with that, I had an opportunity to do a lot of things that, you know, my siblings didn't do with them. And so they thought I was a spoiled brat. Maybe I was.
Maybe you were, but what position were you in the siblings? Were you oldest, in the middle,
young? I was the youngest. Okay. My sister was the youngest, and she was 15 at the time I was born. So people thought that I actually belonged to her. I didn't.
Oh.
I wasn't.
Oh, right. You did say your mom started late when she had her first child. So let's take you from Jamaica. How did you get into the U.S.?
No, I was born here. I'm first generation.
Oh, you were born here, but you are your parents of immigrants. Okay, so when you were young and you were doing that, where were you? Were you in New York? Were you in L.A.? Where were you living?
Boston.
Boston.
Yeah.
And Boston in itself has a lot of cultural things to take attend to.
Oh, very much so. Well, it's a historical city. There was so much that was done there. And, you know, cobblestone streets and the Revolutionary War. So historically, it's an amazing place. When in elementary school, you learn about the Mayflower and, you know, 1492 and the significance of it. Well, let's say a partial significance. We didn't get the full story. But the part of the story that we got every year at school, there would be a pageant, you know, in reference to Thanksgiving time was really huge. So it was very interesting being brought up with very strict. And at the same time, the philosophy and the mentality of and work ethic was very strong, extremely strong, my parents.
Now, when you were growing up, which is very different than some other people in general grew up, what were some of the behavior like? Because right now, there is a running thing, and I hate to say this, and it bothers me. there is on TikTok, Instagram, some of the big social platforms, they now have children talking to the parents as if the children are the parents and the parents are the children.
Oh, no, they now have,
and it's ugly to me because everything that we had that was pure, now they're pulling the kids into because they're innocent and they look adorable on screen and they're so cute, but they're introducing children to an adult world. And in my opinion, I like children to be kids. I don't want to hear a child talking like an adult and they're only 4 or 5 years old. It looks weird and it feels weird.
In my era, it was children are seen and not heard. That was the case then. And if I said something out of turn or asked questions, I didn't like answering questions from a little kid. I was told to go stand in the corner. That I the corners in my house I knew very well. I knew every crack, every crevice, because that was, you just didn't. They didn't talk to you about things. That part was difficult because everything you learned, I'm sure I learned about manners, I learned about food, I learned about a lot of things, but some of the practical things that you need to learn to go outside of your house, it was difficult. In other words, I never heard my family talking about differences between black and white, or that someone was from someplace else and they were treated badly. I never heard those conversations. They were never discussed. Racism wasn't talked about. Now, that's the conversation I heard. I didn't hear it. Doesn't mean it wasn't spoken about. I remember I actually wrote a poem about an incident, actually, where I did know that there was something going on because one night my dad came in from work and my mother was cooking in the kitchen and she had the radio on. And on the radio was a story going down. It was like live happening. And it was of a black man being lynched. And the commentary was as if you were listening to a boxing match. But my mother was just, she just turned like, you know, three shades of white. She was just pale. And my dad, when my dad came in and he started listening, I mean, you could feel the tension in the air.
In the air, yeah.
I mean, it terrified me. It absolutely terrified me. And so, but it wasn't discussed. We heard it on the radio. They never talked to me about it. They never said, oh, you don't have to worry about this. It's not going to happen to you. They just didn't talk about it. And that to me was more frightening. It's really scary. But they did say things to me like, don't look people in the eye. You know, when you're walking down the street, don't look people in the eye. Just look straight ahead. Don't look at
people. Why not?
And see, there was no explanation as to why.
Oh, just don't do it.
That's something you just don't do.
Oh, and, well, maybe it was considered to be too forward or too aggressive towards someone.
Well, you know, I don't know. For me to know what's going on in the world, I have to see it. I walk down the street, I'm looking at everything and looking at everybody. Yeah, I don't think of that as being, if I walk down like this, there's so much of the world I'm missing. And I mean, even the blue sky, trees, flowers, and then of course people, you miss seeing the people that are there. And half of the joy for me is being a people watcher.
I don't know, the rule, everything has shifted so much. It seems like people that want to do the right thing are being shoveled under the rug so that the wrong things can be seen. But at the same time, the wrong things, what perceived to be wrong things, or whatever people call wrong things or right things, is a matter of perception. And who's doing it and why it's being done and the intention behind it. And it's just a big old mess. And I don't know what I wanted to talk to you is that when you were growing and you were learning and you were coming into your own, I don't mean being a child necessarily, but being a young woman of color, were there other women around you to encourage you to keep going? Because you're coming from a time that women weren't allowed to take their clothes off and say who they were, and I'm this, and I'm a miss this, and I've got my, and had so much control over our own sexuality and our own sensuality and our own femininity. What is that like from where you're coming?
Well, it's difficult, and it was difficult for me in that I became a, an unwed mother for a time. And when I say for a time, it was because my son was born and I wasn't married. And then my parents forced me to get married. And that was because they didn't talk to me about sex. They told me nothing. You know, I wanted a boyfriend and I adored him and he adored me. And hey, nature took its course. But I think that that's something that communication is so important, and teaching children and teaching girls how to take care of themselves and how to value themselves so that they don't get caught into situations, even with people that they love. You know, you just really have to take care, because those wounds, they're with you the rest of your life.
Absolutely.
And the idea now that we have that predators are allowed to go free, and we really are a country that traffics in children. I heard just this morning that their ICE is picking up youngsters, kids that are below the age of 18, and they're offering them money to go out of the country, to leave. These are minors. They're offering them money to leave the country on their own. If they're a minor, they need adult supervision here. Now they're sending them, putting them on a plane to go somewhere that they know no one and there isn't anyone to protect them. What are they doing? What is it that we stand for? I mean, and this is because a lot of people think that doing something is okay, doesn't mean it's okay.
Sure.
You know, it's like a lie. A lie remains a lie. I don't care how many people talk about it. Or
it's still a lie. It's
still a lie.
That's
so
right.
That's where we're at now. And mm-hmm. I mean, and it is in everything. In pharmaceuticals, there's television commercials about, oh, ask your doctor if this medication is right for you. Excuse me? That's unethical. What is and should be, the doctor decides that perhaps this is a medication that would help you for what you need. You don't go to the doctor to ask him to give you something after you saw it on television. That is not ethical. But because they've been doing it for the last 45 years, or maybe a little less than that probably, mm-hmm. everybody thinks it's right. So these young people that are coming up now have a different view of the world because they've never known the what certain laws were.
Mm-hmm.
And so now that everybody's behaving like a cowboy, doesn't make it right.
Like a wild, wild west.
That's what it is. It does not make it right. And as far as I'm concerned, now that they've done such a bad job and torn up the White House, literally torn it up, I feel that since it was never really good for us to begin with, that now we should be able to build it back better. Mm-hmm. So we're not building back the same thing, because the same thing, it didn't work for us. It didn't work for people of color. And that's all of us, red, yellow, brown, black. It didn't work for any
of us. Nothing worked. It's not working.
No. So we do need to sit at the table and make change. And I'm hoping that what happened on Tuesday with Prop 50 will be the beginning of people recognizing that if you work together, you can't
move
mountains. You get, yes. And this idea of us being separated has all been designed. It was designed to keep us from being together. Because they know that we have power in numbers. And all that money that they're fooling around and moving, it's our money.
Money.
Mm-hmm. It is ours. It doesn't
We feed up. It comes from the bottom up. People don't understand that. They're playing around with our money. And the only reason that things are the way they are is because people have a tendency to feel like I have no power. I'm working every day. I'm the one paying the bills. I'm the one putting money in the government's pocket. But I have no power. And that's what needs to change. Yes. And I love that you're touching on that subject, because as a woman and as a woman of color, and we'll get more into what you do in the community and how you affect the community, it is really important that we are aware. I don't know about other Black, I have a very unique kind of background. So I don't know about, I can't get into the, you know, all of the, everybody in one bucket, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Although I understand across the board, there are these kinds of experiences. But in terms of how people experience, I came from a similar background. Both my parents were educated to a certain degree. My dad, all the men in our family were military people. They just didn't talk about Black. They didn't do that. Mm-hmm. Nobody came around to me, oh, yeah, you Black. I mean, they said you were Black. But it was in a negative, especially my mother, in a negative towards you, like you Black Poe and ugly or something like that. But it wasn't in a return of like, oh, yeah, we're Black and they're white. And, you know, and you got to nothing like that. I don't know what that means. And then also my mother worked for very wealthy white people. She cleaned their homes. And my mom because of that, you probably, and I want to hear what your experience, because of that, I was able to get a little bit different of kind of reference to value, what you place value on, what you protect, and what how you do this and that. And she was always very careful about us not touching other people's things and having respect for other people. Like you ask first, you do this first before you do anything. So I wanted to hear something about how, as a woman and being a person of vision, how you've been able to keep your future filled with hope after coming out of all the things you've come out of.
Oh yeah. And you haven't even heard of all the things I've come out of.
I want to hear them.
Well, the thing is, excuse me, one second. All of a sudden, my sinuses have kicked in.
Oh, it's fine. No, it's fine. We're human here.
Well, let's see. Okay, what was it?
No, it's okay. We were talking about how you were able to come out of those situations, being where you are now, and still have a hope-filled future. Still felt like the future's going to be brighter. It's going to be better. I'm not going to be like my mom. I'm not going to be, you know, how did you work through
that? Well, I'll tell you, it's very easy to get bogged down into the past. Very easy to do that. What you really have to do is recognize the past, see what your mistakes were, and you can still look at what others' mistakes are, but it's not about placing blame. It's about looking at the past, recognizing it, living in the present, and doing what you have to do to create the future that you want. Mm-hmm. And when you're doing that, you have to focus. There are things that you have to do. You have to recognize that your family, your friends, they don't always have your best interest at heart. And so if you want to do something, you really can't talk to them about what you want to do. You have to keep it close to the vest. Talk to those people that you know you'll get support from, and those people who are going to give you direction, the right direction. But you have to be focused. You have to be focused on the prize. You are the prize. You have to take care of yourself first before you can take care of anybody else. Mm-hmm. And I believe that that's the same thing that's true of happiness. If I'm happy, I can be with someone else That's also a person that has some happiness going. I can't make anybody happy. That when people think, oh, well, I'll be with him and I'll make him do this and he can do that and then I'll be happy. No, it doesn't work
that way. It doesn't work like that.
It really doesn't. And so, and the same thing is true of success. Yes, you can share success, but you are able to share it better with those people that have been building it with you and those people who've been there supporting you. And sometimes there isn't anyone to support you but you. And you have to cut off those tapes that are in your head that say, I'm not enough, I can't do this, I'm not pretty enough, I'm not tall enough, I'm not... But cut out all of the I am nots, because that part truly isn't true. Mm-hmm. There is virtually nothing that you can't do if you put your mind to it. I mean, truly. We have this young man in New York that now is going to be the mayor of New York. Everybody told him, what are you doing this for? You're nuts. It's never going to happen for you.
And he did it.
He did it. He's celebrating. He wouldn't have known whether he could do it or not if he didn't do it. And that is the biggest problem for most people is the word fear. They're afraid of failing. And what they don't understand about failing is that's the biggest blessing that you could have, because that meant that you put out the effort to do something. And so it didn't work. What did you learn from it? That's the big thing.
That's the baby right there.
You learned something from that. And then that's something that you can run with now because you made some mistakes. I don't want to be around anybody that says, oh, no, I've never made any mistakes. Everything's been perfect. We got somebody in the White House right now that's like that. And he's never done anything. He has never done anything. Businessman? He's not a businessman. If he were a businessman, he would know how to take all of these problems that we have right now.
And do it, yeah.
And turn them into gold for himself. But he doesn't know how to do that.
A lot of people don't. That's what the interesting thing is, that we place, and I can't put everything on a president. I cannot. Because we place so much responsibility on one person. They come in and take some shit somebody else screwed up. Then they screw up. Then they come in screwed up. Then come in screwed up in the head. And then come in and screw up everything else even further. And I don't think people, in order to run a country, it takes a particular kind of person. And able to run a country thoroughly. First of all, you have to be unselfish. You have to think of yourself, but you also have to think about the welfare and the care of other people, everybody, not just your people with money, not just white, not just black, not just whatever. Everybody in the country. And America is a globe, a global melting pot of everyone. So that's the first consideration is that everybody lives here. We got to take care of everyone. And not everybody's going to be happy. But I guarantee you that if I were president, I would call in everybody from every sector of the community. I need people that are teenagers down in the black community. Mm-hmm. I need folk over in the Asian community that are out on the streets. Tell me what's going on out there, because I'm not out in the streets. I don't know. None of my people know, because they don't know what it's like to be in the streets. They've never not had a home to live in. Mm-hmm. So why don't you come up here and tell us about what it means to be on the streets? And tell us what your needs are out there so that we can better serve you. You black folk, why don't you come up here and tell us what the big issues are in your community? And rather than talk about them, let's develop some task force within those communities that we don't give money to. We give them, we have to pay them out and not let anyone take over anything that has to do with money, because apparently the funding is not going where it's supposed to go. Because if it were, things would look a lot differently. I'm not being real here. So I don't know about Trump or whoever's in the office. All I know is that whatever is going on, it is out of harmony and out of sync. Everybody's moving in all these different directions. And the one is blaming this one. Both of you are at fault. If two parents are in a marriage and the kid is something's wrong with the kid, both parents need to sit down and say, what did you do?
Well, see, when you say that, you're actually describing both parties, because the Democrats are at fault, too. you know, a lot of them are very complacent, and they had been complacent, and they just, you know, they get their money, they have their lobbyists, and they have people that are putting in their putting in money to get them elected, and therefore the people really get shortchanged. And so both parties are at fault. And I look at it now as we're going to rebuild this country, build it back. It doesn't look the way it looked, you know, during the revolutionary times. It looks very different. And even then, the people who really fought in those wars to make this country free don't get the credit for doing it. And are always, you know, push back, push back, push down, and slavery. We still have forms of slavery today.
Because everybody wants a slave. Nobody wants to do the work. Everybody wants somebody to do the work for them.
What I believe should happen is, because we've got to take this really right back to those founding fathers' words, and we have to change that. We have to look at and listen to the words of our Native Americans who to this day still protect this land when they can, and who have more heart than could be imagined. We don't hear their voices. We need to hear their voices. And we need to have that grassroots conversation about the Constitution. And we need to take the Constitution and take it apart. This needs to happen all over the country, that there are groups that sit down made up of everybody. And we have the same questions. And we go through those questions and we figure out how we need to change it so that it is good for everyone. And it means that not that 1% is going to be ruling. Because you got to remember, the men that were doing this were all white. They were all wealthy. They were all landowners. They had a stake in profits. And that was why slavery. George Washington was a slaveholder. You know, I mean, this was business to them. And we have to take that out of the equation and look at how we build people's lives and how we have an education system that works for everyone, that we have neighborhoods everywhere that have trees and flowers and have markets that have good produce and food for the neighborhoods, you know, and we have to have people who are thriving. There was a time there were people that were thriving. We had a full middle class, which made it possible for the very poor to work and have jobs. Mm-hmm. And we had an immigrant population that helped tremendously by doing the jobs that no American wants to do. And that they would come in from outside of the country. They would come in from Mexico. They would come in annually to take care of what we have here. They would make their money and they would leave. And then they would come back again. And all of the people that have been deported, that's criminal. That is criminal to snatch people off the street.
Oh, just like animals.
Yes.
You know, and at the same, but you know what people get to see? The people that are living present day get to see perhaps what slavery was like. But even worse, you don't get to experience people being lit on fire in front of your face, or your parents being shot in front of your face. Now, people from other countries, I had a woman I had on my show many years ago, and she was, when she was a young girl, Stalin was in power. In Russia. So she literally watched all of her family get shot and murdered in front of her face.
Oh my God.
And when you go through things like that, I mean, we don't have a heart.
That's what this president wanted to do. He wants to be able to have a militia, not a militia, but have the National Guard or our Marines and Army of folks come in to do training. What does that mean? These guys are trained to kill. Is that what they're coming to do in our cities? I don't think so. But that's...
It looks like television. To me, as I say often, everything that we do, we mimic what we've seen on TV. I mean, these are things that used to be on television. With people coming in and taking people over. And then now they're happening in real life. And then I was watching, I'm a huge fan of Rod Serling and the Outer Limits because they are so far in advance. Yes. But there was one little thing on Rod Serling on Twilight Zone where this guy is a bigot, is a white guy. He has his other friends. He's always talking about everybody. Oh, the damn N-word. Oh, the damn Russian. He was against everybody. So I love Rod Serling. Said, let's have him visit the Twilight Zone. So by the time my man got to be black, every time he tried to say something, they'd throw him into one of the worlds that he hated. So even though in his own mind he was white, in the scene he looked black to everybody else, or he looked German to everybody else, or he looked whatever he was against. Even one of them was Asian, because he was against the Japanese too and talking about them all the time. And at the end, he ends up being hauled off in a refugee, like a train or whatever they locked them up in, and screaming to his friends, help me. It's me. It's me. So I love the fact that before this lifetime is over, and I will say with all confidence, everybody will get to feel like what it feels like to be black. Before this thing is over, everybody will get to feel like what we've been feeling like for a very long time. You'll get to understand now that it's not just a joke and we're not just complaining. Well, you'll get to experience what it feels like. And for those people that have never had to go through something, I feel bad for you. You're not trained to go through anything, so you probably fall apart.
Yeah.
Where and people have had to suffer and go through things their whole life, we're tough as steel. We're resilient. We know how to hang. We know what to do.
From the moment we walk out the door as a kid, you know what you have to do. You're told what to do. When my kids were in their teens, it was all about, be really careful because you don't know what these policemen are going to do. And we lived in Beverly Hills for a time, and while they were in high school, and they were stopped all the time. All the time they were stopped. Until finally, the kids did a concert at school, and they hired some Beverly Hills police officers, or one in particular they hired. And once he came and was around the kids, it stopped. It never happened again.
Because they got to experience the children and the kind of people.
Yeah, and they knew these are kids they're interested in.
These are good kids.
Yeah, they have to practice. In order to play the way they played and to do what they do, they have to practice. Mm-hmm. So they're not messing around doing other things. And, police were coming to my house all the time, knocking on the door. Your music. My neighbors would complain about the music.
We're going to take a quick station break for a moment. Let's shout out to our sponsor again. Then we're going to come back and talk to Dorsey some more about her life and what she's done. Kevin Pike, Coldwell Banker, 818-571-1508. He's a senior real estate and probate specialist. All day long, all night long, whenever you want to talk to him, he is there to talk to you. And I am so happy that I have had the pleasure of knowing him in this lifetime. Back to Dorsey. So Dorsey, I wanted to ask you, you served on many, many boards, the board of directors on many community organizations. You've come out of trade shows. I wanted you to explain to people what the difference between a trade show and a convention or a regular convention is. And then I want you to talk about Making Music LA, how that came about, and why you think women are so important to be community leaders and to be at the forefront of community affairs. That's a big one, and I will shut up.
Okay. Well, yeah, I did have the pleasure of working in the trade show industry, and that was pretty remarkable. My start in that actually came from being the executive director of an organization called California Fashion Creators. And what that was California designers and sportswear designers and the couture designers. It was an organization that actually was sort of, you know, when we get to be the head of it, it's on its way out. It's not going up in those days, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And what was the name of the organization?
California Fashion Creators.
California Fashion Creators.
It was started probably in the late 30s, early 40s.
And it
was sportswear designers and all the designers who, sorry, my eye is bothering me. Give me just
it's
one
fine.
Second. Sorry.
No, you're fine.
It's tearing up my sinuses. Oh.
No, it's fine. You're fine.
Anyway, as I said, it started in the 40s. So they had all of these various designers like Adrian and let's see who else. I can't think of some of the names of some of the now. But it came down to even folks who were, you know, designing for films. And Adrian was one of those designers. And Edith Head was. I actually gave an award to Edith Head. She didn't receive it in person herself, but we had a fashion show at the California Apparel Mart, and she was in the hospital dying at the time, but it was the last award that she received. Mm-hmm. And it was really such an experience for me. But again, this was something that becoming the executive director of that association was something that my friend said, well, they're never going to give that to you. That'll never happen. And so you might as well not even go for the interview. I said, well, I'm already in the office. And yes, I am going to interview for it because I'm the best person for it.
That's right.
And yeah, and I went into the interview with the president. And I said, you know, I know this. The person that you had here before really didn't know the industry. And there are things that I'll be able to do that will make a big difference. And I stuck to my guns. And he said, yeah, fine. Yeah, why not? And so he let me do it. And as a result of that, I mean, we had to get the permission of the board as well. But as a result of becoming that, I ended up taking California designers to Dallas, Texas, and to Chicago and into New York.
Oh, wow, look at that.
And we named it California Gold Futures was one of the shows that we called it. And it was the beginning of a trade show because what we were doing was a trade. These were all people in the fashion industry, in the garment industry. So these fashion houses and the houses that were sportswear designers were really the ones that were leading. And the sportswear, meaning swimwear. There was also a show that was called ISAM, which was the International Swimwear Activewear Market. And so
really?
I led that as well.
ISWAM, ISWAM.
ISAM, S-A-M.
Oh, ISAM.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so I headed that, and we had a huge show, a fashion event, you know, during market time, which is when we would do things. And then I then gathered these designers and took them to Dallas. Now, on the first Dallas show, Mayor Tom Bradley gave me a proclamation to support that. He was wonderful.
And, he was amazing.
Yes, he was. And so I got that from him. And then I had a company that I had gone to see. I also sold the show. I had to take these designers. So I had to go and talk to them, where they lived in their factories and talk to them to come and be a part of this show. Because I was making it not just the California designers, but making it a California lifestyle. So we'd have orange juice, we'd have wine, we'd have sourdough bread from San Francisco. We just, had all these things that made you think about California. And so one of the companies would go see, and he said, no, you know, really not interested in doing it. I said, look, if you do this show, you're going to pick up, a sales group in Dallas that will make all the difference to your brand. And we really weren't using brand at the time. That word didn't come up until a little bit later. But that was, in essence, what I was telling him. And so finally, at the last minute, it was late Friday afternoon, I get a call from him. He says, I'm sending my girl over with the check, and we're going to do it. So I said, great. So in those days, we didn't have the computer that we were putting the program together with.
And I had to deliver everything.
Yeah, this was like cut and paste. And so I had to cut and paste and put their name in the book, in the program book. And it was going like this when it finally came to print. It wasn't straight. It was going like this. The company was Guess.
Guess?
Guess.
Oh, my God.
Guess was the company. And they
Guess
were,
means, yeah.
They were picked up in Dallas. And that made the difference.
Wow.
That was their start, because at that time, Dallas was booming in oil and there was lots of money. And so they picked up one of the best sales houses, and that took them, and the rest was history. I can say this little black girl had something to do with that. $20 can buy me coffee, you know?
Oh, yeah. Use big money then.
they made me a citizen of Dallas, and they brought me back for another event where who was a famous designer here. Oh God, I can't think of his name now. But anyway, he was doing a show down there. It was charitable, for charity and stuff, and I went back down for that. And I'll send you some pictures sometimes.
I would love that. Well, I need them because I want to do the article to go with this show. So if you can send them to me, I'll include it in the blog post and everything.
Okay, great.
But oh my gosh, so talk a little bit about, because we're running out of time, and I wanted you to talk a little bit about what you're doing in community affairs, because you've taken that broad background that you've had and then you've applied it to a community affairs program. And I wanted to know, what we can expect from the county of LA in the future. What does it look like? Where are we going? What about Hollywood? Is Hollywood going to be around, or the aliens are going to take it over? What's happening? Because everything seems to be kind of falling apart.
Yeah, I think everything does have that perception, but I think that in some instances, it's a good thing, because again, as I said, it's what we have in our lives is change constantly. It's constantly evolving and changing. And what we see now is we see more films from people of color. We have more platforms for them to display.
Definitely.
And so, we can't say, well, you know, we have nowhere to be. There's only one place in this slot over here, because those film companies now have the competition of the Hulus,
all these little people,
the Peacocks, the Spectrums,
the Amazon, everybody's in the business.
Yeah, everybody's in the business. Everybody wants a piece. And I think there's room for that. And I really learned that during COVID, for example. Mm-hmm. My opportunity to watch films from all over the world. I mean, African films, Turkish films, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, love Korean drama.
That's me. I love it.
Oh, you know, and the thing is, the storytelling from all these different ethnicities is magnificent.
Magnificent, yeah.
You know, people think that in Africa, everyone, you know, has a house with a dirt floor. Guess again, folks. You need to pay attention. These are big, beautiful cities with corporations that
more money than we have. Okay. More money than we have. I love that. But listen, we're close to time to go. I want to give my people out here, thank you, you guys. I love you. I love you for being who you are. Waking up every day, for looking in the mirror and smiling. Ganga, you can do this. You can do this. And then I like you for being brave, doing what you got to do to get where you got to go, and not fussing or complaining about it, just accepting. There's a Buddhist saying to suffer what there is to suffer and to enjoy what there is to enjoy and consider them both as facts of life. So I want to leave you with that. And also, shout out to Sam Hassan, LA Talk Radio. Thank you for letting me shine every week, Sam. You're doing such a great job. And also, without your liking us, please like and subscribe. We need the number. Numbers aren't a big deal to me, but apparently they are to you out there, or whoever the powers may be. So let's beef it up, you know, keep the people of our, you know, our people in there, everybody that wants to be aware, those futurists and progressive thinkers that we all have. And don't forget to smile. It works wonders. My IG hashtag is Osiris_Munir_the painter. And Dorsey, what's your hashtag?
Don't have a hashtag. #MakeMusicLA.
Make Music LA. And I need you really quickly to explain what Make Music LA is and give us the website so everybody can go on and check it out. Or okay. IG.
Make Music LA is a one-day music festival that happens on June 21st annually. It started in France about 45 years ago as the Fête de la Musique, and it takes place every year, and it's around the country, and we do it on June 21st. So take a look at our website. It's makemusicla.org. Thank you for inviting me to be here. I've had a great time. Happy to come back anytime.
I want you back, and we have learned so much. I love people with stories. They got some shit into some stuff. They got something to talk about. Not somebody like, oh, I read a magazine, I saw it on social media, so I have a conversation. These people really have conversations that we bring onto our show, and you can tell they have conversation. Because every time I have someone on here, I expand my neural pathway so much more than they would have been had I just been stuck to little of what I think. So Dorsey, again, do you have anything, last words you want to say before we get off the air?
I would just like to say to folks, you know, we're going through some difficult times, but just know that it will change, and do what you can do in your community. You can join a neighborhood council and take part. There's 99 of them in the city of Los Angeles. So if you're in LA, you can do that. And wherever you are, get involved in your community. You can do something. Don't just sit and say, oh, you know, not for me. Every vote counts. So
we can make a change. We're all just regular people born and die just like everybody else. Ain't nobody bigger than nobody else. It's just the decisions and what we decide to do with ourselves that matter. Yes. And on that note, I love y'all. Talk to you later, Kendrys. Don't forget, be good. And don't get no trouble out there until I see you next week. Bye-bye. Thank you, Dorsey.
You're listening to The Osiris Munir Show, only on LA Talk Radio.